Sin acknowledges and pays respect to the traditional owners of the land on which the Sin office and studios stand, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations. Sin also acknowledges and pays respect to the traditional owners of the lands our content reaches, as well as the radio stations we broadcast from across the country.
Welcome to Film 101, the show that looks at everything film, from the biggest new releases to awards hype, right through to interviews with practitioners working on films, and our film recommendations. I am your host, Arnie, and alongside me today are fellow co-hosts Darcy and Tom, and we will be discussing two recent animations as we head into the sunny and, for some, snowy holiday season. I know it's somewhat sunny for us, depending on where you are in the world. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, it's been quite cold in Melbourne today, so yeah, it may as well be snowing.
Yeah, we're about as far from summer as you can get. So, but without further ado, I think we will head straight into the wondrous world of Sergio Pablos's Klaus. Now, I pronounced that Claus before I saw it. I don't know whether you guys thought the same thing.
Well, I thought exactly the same, because it's a Christmas movie, so you just think to yourself, Claus. And then my inner German came through, and I was like, no, it's pronounced Klaus.
It is Klaus. Mm. And the plot, according to Netflix, and it is a Netflix original, is a selfish postman and a reclusive toy maker form an unlikely friendship, delivering joy to a cold, dark town that desperately needs it. Thoughts, guys? Thoughts on this one? I know we all saw it, I believe, last night. So What were your first impressions upon seeing it?
It was surprisingly powerful. I mean, Arnie, you were saying off air before, I'm an absolute sucker for animation. So I think I was always going to enjoy this, but I didn't think it would be as enjoyable as what it was. I mean, it was just so emotionally resonant. It was heartfelt. It was just such a beautiful film.
Do you feel that it's the sort of Christmas film that should be made more often? Like a kind of
I feel like it's a real Christmas film. And not like whenever we talk about like the best Christmas movie, it's always like a tangential one, like Home Alone or
Die Hard. Yeah.
And it's like, and this one's actually like about the mythology that like created Santa. Mm.
That's the thing, because we see a lot of these movies about the origin of Christmas and the origin of Santa Claus. So it's nothing new, but it's the way in which it tells this story, I think, which is somewhat original.
I felt that originality, at least in the first half. Now, I don't know whether you guys agree with me. I thought that was subversive in and of, like, in the way that it kind of went about it, because, you know, you're not getting your traditional Santa film, and it's not, he's not the protagonist in this film either. It is the postman, voiced by Jason Schwartzman. But you've also got that kind of thread between kind of two disparate sort of groups going against each other in this town, which, you know, where the postman goes. But like, the further the film went on and the more the kind of, because it's an hour and 38 minutes long, so there's a lot that you got to do in that time, and, you know, animations have, like, they have to do so much in such a short amount of time in order to kind of get the story across while, you know, getting, keeping you entertained at the same time. But I found in the second half that it kind of deviated from that originality and fell more into just a conventional sort of Christmas tale.
I thought exactly the opposite, actually. I thought the story started out really conventional. I could tell where I was heading, but it was in the second half of the film where it sort of turned it on its head, and it's like, oh, okay. That's the twist.
Okay, see, I saw it more like in the way you did, that like it started kind of in a different kind of lens, but I feel like I really enjoyed how it kind of rounded out into a more traditional story. I felt like it was much more personable and more interesting, I think, that way.
I understand that, Darcy. I agree with you in that sense. But I just felt like a lot of what it was doing, like there was a lot of motifs in there that are just akin to your traditional kind of Christmas Santa films that, you know, I can get from any other sort of Christmas film if I choose to watch it. Whereas, you know, as well, like here, Santa, he's obviously, he's not, he's, I don't think he's ever referred to as Santa either.
No.
Which, yeah, so they keep it as Klaus, which, mind you, is kind of like, it's almost like a Hitler. If Hitler was like an archetype who was a lumberjack, do you know what I mean?
I'm sorry.
And was just like giving to people, this is kind of like the character that he would be. But yeah, I don't know. I just never really connected with him on like an emotional or spiritual level. No, that was where I was going with that, Tom.
I was going to leave that hanging down.
I'm sorry. How do you
both confused.
How do you correlate Santa Claus with Hitler? I mean,
Klaus. I just figured he's like a German lumberjack who's come here and he's really giving to people. So he's kind of like the archetype that Hitler could have become. I don't know.
Yes, but he's spreading joy and happiness, not fear and hatred.
Exactly. Exactly. Or rather, the alter ego that he could have become. There we go.
Right, okay.
Yeah. In terms of the cast, so it's got Jason Schwartzman as Jesper, who's the main protagonist here. J.K. Simmons is Klaus. Rashida Jones is Alva. Mrs. Crumb is voiced by Joan Cusack. Norm MacDonald is in there as well as Mogens. Sergio Pavlos himself is Pumpkin or Olaf. Olaf is the character from Frozen as well, isn't he?
Yes. Yeah. You're allowed to have characters with the same name.
Yeah, there's
no law.
I know, but... Yeah, no, it's really confusing because we're going to be talking about Frozen as well in here, so not to be confused with the other Olaf. And Will Sasso is Mr. Ellingbow. Okay, so the film was nominated at the Hollywood Music and Media Awards for the HMMA Award for Best Original Song in an animated film for the song Invisible. I feel like that was... Yeah, that's like the main song that runs throughout the film, right?
Although, the music choice in this movie are really strange. Like, it has that sort of, like, the early 2000s with Treasure Planet and Titan AE, they kind of have this weird vibe of, like, having, like, a really normal score and then just throwing in, like, pop or rock music that just makes no sense. You're like, this is a good song, but, like, I don't know why this is here. And it kind of pulls you out of a movie that's, like, really working to, like, invest you into the story.
You know, it's kind of like putting Gary Glitter's Rock and Roll in a movie about
him. Oh,
God. Well, I think
that aged poorly as soon as it happened.
It really did.
Well, I think that's the difference between this and, like, Disney films, which rely so heavily on its songs, and we'll discuss that with Frozen 2 in the next segment. Whereas, yeah, with here, it's less so. It's more kind of... And it's got that conventional animation as well, the style that we haven't seen quite as such, but it's kind of making a comeback with, you know, that 2D sort of animated style. And obviously we've seen Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse kind of subverting the way that it's gone about presenting animation as well.
So, yeah, I'm pretty sure that Klaus was animated with Flash software. And, yeah, it's got that 2D aesthetic, that early Disney sort of vibe, and it's got that 3D cell-shaded animation, I guess you could call it, brought into it as well. I think that Disney has been trying to incorporate that technology into their films for years now, and they haven't been able to master it. So it's good to see that at least one studio has somewhat got a hand on it.
Well, this sort of animation, I think, has been around for, like, since, like, early 2000s with, like, Treasure Planet, those sort of movies, where it is, like, the non-Disney kind of animation aesthetic. And I think the lighting for this movie is actually incredible. Like, that's the thing that stood out to me. And because most people online have been talking about just how visually striking this movie is, which is, like, what you don't really get from a lot of animation movies.
Can I just point out, Treasure Planet is a Disney movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's officially part of the Disney canon. All
right.
Yeah.
You're mentioning, like, the visuals and how they stood out for a lot of people. Upon seeing the stills, I thought it was going to be a much more warmer film than what it ended up kind of becoming. Like, it was, a lot of the scenes were, like, much more harshly lit and much more
dark.
It's
like,
the
setting, kind of lends itself to that sort of lighting.
Klaus is... He's an intimidating, imposing figure. Like, he's not like your conventional Santa. And I think a lot of that's owed to the fact that, you know, he does... There are issues in there with his character in terms of how he's, I guess, somewhat troubled as well, his sort of troubled life. I thought there could have been a bit more exploration with that thread. I think it was just left hanging for a bit, you know, and, like, in terms of, you know, his wife's kind of gone, and then where's he come from this background? He's like, how's he managing that? And he's automatically kind of met Jesper, and he's automatically thrust back into this giving life. There was a lot in there that was kind of, you just can't fit so much in an hour and 38 minutes.
There were some familiar beats in there. I mean, there's the tragic backstory. There's what has been described as the liar revealed storyline.
I hate that.
Yeah,
just tropes.
It's like, I think, I don't know whether either of you two have seen The Nostalgia Critic on YouTube, but it's one of his top 10 most hated tropes. How, you know, how someone has this ulterior motive for what they're otherwise doing out of the goodness of their heart.
Yeah.
That's just like movie logic that doesn't actually work in the real world in any way.
No, I mean, if this actually happened in real life, people would not react
in the way that
these characters reacted. It's almost as if the writers have never faced conflict in their entire lives.
And I don't know about you guys as well, but for me, the closing sequence was rather abrupt. I thought that was resolved really quickly. Like, do you know what I mean?
I feel like the pacing of the movie is a bit odd because I was really impressed with how much they got through in the first, like, 15 minutes. Like, it's like breakneck pace. And then kind of the middle, it's kind of like... kind of lends itself to a more normal kind of pacing. And then the end, it kind of like slows down and then gets like really quick for the last like 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah, because it thrusts you into, you know, Jesper's into the media race of Jesper's story. You're straight away in the thick of it, and as he's kind of casting the journey, I mentioned here as well. Like, I was getting kind of Billy Madison vibes in terms of, oh, he's just like a lounging around dude, and then his father interferes. And he's
It was kind of weird. His character, there's like pretty much the first 7 minutes, he's different than the rest of the movie.
Well, that was something I mentioned as well. It's like how quickly his character kind of
develops
and kind of progresses and becomes, I guess, who his father wants him to be, or maybe who he realizes who he wants to be as well in some sense. Mm. I thought that was quite abrupt. So there was, it's hard to do so much in an hour and 38 minutes. And to have so many, like, there wasn't a lot of character arcs, but there's, a lot of kind of complex issues as well that could have been, I think, fleshed out more. I don't know how Netflix would have gone about extending this animation to 2 hours.
I think it's kind of goes back to, like, what exactly the audience for this is. Is it like, do they want to go full child-friendly? Like, no Netflix is going to be shown to millions of children. Mm. Do they want to do that? Or do they want to put in a little bit more to, like, make this a more interesting, kind of complex movie?
Honestly, I think they've found the perfect balance. Yeah, because it's, you know, approachable enough for, even though it's got a PG rating, I mean, I think that younger children, it would be accessible for, but even like older audiences, parents can get a kick out of this
and
one.
And I found it really nostalgic to like, specifically like The Emperor's New Groove, like that sort of early 2000s animated movie.
Mm.
Yeah.
I guess at the end of the day, for me, I can appreciate it for what it is. But yeah, I could easily go to something like, and I put in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
I don't think you're giving this movie enough credit, Arnie, honestly. Yeah. Because it says that Christmas is like this year-round thing. It's all-encompassing, all-embodying. It's not just this one time of the year where you spread goodwill and cheer. It just happens constantly.
I guess we don't celebrate Christmas in my family, so that could be a reason as well that maybe I couldn't resonate with it as much as maybe you can. Mm. But yeah, at the end of the day, I just thought I could have got the same sort of messages. And yeah, because like obviously that animation is nostalgic and reminiscent of a time that's, you know, kind of long past. But I feel like I could have got the same sort of moral grounding and moral messages from another sort of Christmas film, like National Lampoon's, which, again, brings that comedic sort of value as well to me, which I think is also something that it's encompassed in Christmas, you know, that how we kind of... I don't know how you celebrate it, Tom, but...
I don't know. Now all I can think about is that scene with the cat and the Christmas tree. It's
just... Brilliant scene, Tom. And I just wanted to lastly mention the critical scores. So it's got 8.4 on IMDb, 91% on Rotten Tomatoes. And what did it have on Metacritic?
I believe it was 63% when we checked just before.
63%, yeah. You're listening to the Film 101 podcast on Sin. We're going to head into our second segment of the day, looking at another animation in Frozen 2, the sequel or follow-up to the widely successful, both critically and commercially, Frozen, I think from 2013 it was.
Correct. Yes, I remember it well.
Of course you do. Well, I don't, because I never watched it, Tom. This is my first Frozen, so I view this as Frozen 1. I think that one might be Frozen 2, so I'm going in like a reverse order, because there's no title, like follow-up title to Frozen 2, it's just Frozen 2.
Frozen, the prequel.
That's what it should be called, yeah. So the directors here are Jennifer Lee and Chris Buck. Are they returning directors?
Yeah, so they are the same two directors from the first movie, and Jennifer Lee is now the head of Walt Disney Animation Studios since John Lasseter and his impropriety.
Well, I think this was the last film that John Lasseter worked on.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's kind of his signing off. In terms of the plot, according to IMDb, Anna Elsa Christoph Olaf, not to be confused with the Olaf from Klaus, and Sven leave Arendelle to travel to an ancient autumn-bound forest of an enchanted land. They set out to find the origin of Elsa's powers in order to save their kingdom. The film basically stars Idina Menzel again as Elsa, Kristen Bell as Anna, Josh Gad as Olaf, Jonathan Groff as Kristoff, Sterling K. Brown's in there as Matthias, Evan Rachel Wood is Iduna, Alfred Molina is Agna, Jason Ritter is Ryder, Martha Plimpton is Yelena, Jeremy Sisto is King Runyard, and Alan Tudyk, always mistake his name, plays a multitude of roles as the guard, Northuldra leader, Arendellian soldier, my bad, and Duke of Wesselton. What were your guys' impressions of Frozen 2, seeing as you've both seen the first one? How do you think this one lived up? Did it live up to the potential of the first one, or...?
It's kind of the same.
Yeah?
Like... Well, I know, like, it kind of struggles with some of the same issues that the first one had, and it kind of works in the same way as the first one did.
No, I agree with that. It's more or less the same movie, and for that reason, it doesn't have the same resonance as the first film did, because it felt so fresh and energetic. It felt like Disney was back. And this one, there isn't that same sense of euphoria that comes with it, which is unfortunate. But with that said, Frozen 2 is still a good film.
And it's also going to make about $2 billion. So I think
they're predicting that, actually.
Perfectly fine with that.
Well, yeah, it's making $1 billion in the next couple of days, which is, a huge milestone.
It's breaking so many records,
A lot of records.
I don't think it's going to, it might surpass the original Frozen, but it's not going to have the same cultural impact that the original Frozen did.
The first Frozen happened, 2013, and I feel like it's never left.
Yeah.
It go has just kind of just been around.
And I mean, it was very much a slow burn movie. When it originally came out Thanksgiving in America, people were like, oh yeah, this is like a cool film. And the people who really loved it were really pushing it. Like the word of mouth was huge. And it got to the point where it reached January 2014 and Frozen was number one again after being in cinema.
And Let It Go was like one of the most successful songs of the decade.
Yeah, after being in cinema for over 6 weeks, and then it got released in more international territories, and then it became the highest grossing animated movie of all time.
Well, yeah, again, I haven't seen Frozen 1, and I know Let It Go as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean,
doesn't matter. Yeah.
Well, and merchandising-wise, this film, like the first one, it's just managed to sell so much. And again, like with this one, they've introduced new characters as well. I think there's like a fire salamander in there, and there's some other kind of new whimsical
good
creatures.
Good adorable stuff. Yeah.
Good adorable stuff that sells well. So that's the name of the game at Disney. I think it is definitely made purely for kids. You can get there's some Disney films, obviously Toy Story is one of them, where I think adults can connect. Everyone can find something for themselves in these sort of films. I think with this one, it's kind of I've mentioned here, like sisterhood and companionship. They're really big themes. I think that a lot of people can connect with. But yeah, it is purely made for children. I mean, those item numbers and those musicals and those songs are made to get the kids up and dancing and singing.
I felt like those themes were definitely better handled in the first one than the second. Like, I feel like this one, it didn't really add much to that kind of idea.
I think, though, that Frozen 2, it's talking about, or rather, it's pitching itself to an older audience, because in the first act especially, they talk about growing up and becoming more mature, and they deal with some more mature themes in this movie. So they recognize that Frozen's audience has grown up.
Yeah, it was kind of doing the Toy Story 2 kind of idea of, we know we haven't been here in 5 years and the audience is the same but 5 years older, so we're just addressing that same audience.
Yeah, but they're still pitching it to kids that are just starting to pick up on Frozen and starting
to grow up.
There's
still 3-year-olds that are seeing this movie.
Yeah, exactly.
And they shouldn't be.
They're keeping it kind of tailored towards both sort of demographics. I understand what you're saying, Tom, as well, in terms of trying to appeal to that audience that grew up with the first film, unlike myself. But in terms of the songs, because we have mentioned them, how do you guys think these ones fared up? Because they are, we've mentioned just before as well, they're really fundamental to Disney films, the songs, and I guess in how they shape the film and how they shape certain scenes and add almost a new layer to particular scenes and elevate them in some way. So how do you think these ones fared
I feel
up?
Like the music was, like the specific songs were used more as a crutch than it felt like in the first one. Like it felt like the dialogue scenes are kind of just ramping up to the next song, whereas Frozen it kind of happened into it, and like Let It Go felt more organic than the songs in this one.
Well, it's kind of interesting you mentioned that, because the two songwriters being Robert Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez, they are credited as screenwriters in this movie.
Oh, okay.
So I would say
that's
they had a huge part in helping to shape the story.
They're still probably going to win an Oscar for the main song out of this, because
More than likely.
Yeah.
I view it in the same sense as you. I think it's songs for song's sake. Like, we've had Let It Go. Let's try to create something else. Because once that gets clicked in your head, you're constantly referring to it. Like, even years on, people, if they sing that song, they'll know what film it came from.
That's not to say that, the music, the individual songs in this movie are still good. And I think they the actual music quality is still pretty high compared to most films, sort of thing.
I thought they were quite forgetful. I can't really... I'm saying this as someone who... I haven't seen Frozen 1, but I know Let It Go. Whereas here, I've
but
watched...
But that's also that's like 6 years worth of kind of pop culture happening.
Yeah, so it's sort of been shoved into your brain, so to speak. And if you listen to the other songs in the Frozen soundtrack as well, you will love them. Like, they are catchy.
In
properly catchy.
The first
catchy.
One or this
yeah,
one?
The first one.
Yeah. Again, there are songs that I did like. I think there was one in there that I mentioned, Show Yourself. That one kind of...
Yeah, I think that's the standout, even though it's not, Into the Unknown is the one that's probably going to win the Oscar, but Show Yourself is definitely, the best song.
My personal favourite was Lost in the Woods, which is, a riff on those 80s power ballad songs.
Yeah, they finally got Jonathan Groff to sing. He, for some reason, didn't sing in the first movie.
Well, he did, but he was only, strumming a ukulele.
And in terms of the visuals, how have they fared up? Because Disney's animations are probably the strongest out there. I think alongside sort of DreamWorks, with, you know, the How to Train Your Dragon films, which were incredible at the time. But yeah, how do you think the animations fared up, you know, five, 6 years on?
I think it was really effective to have, like, part of the storytelling is that they go into, like, the autumn kind of environment. Because I think you can only do glorious looking ice sculptures for like two whole movies that like kind of go into the forest. It was much more interesting.
Yeah.
And I think by doing that, there's a level of simplicity. Do you know what I mean? If you're just going around sort of ice and trees and you're keeping it around like the sort of natural things that we can see and touch and feel and then kind of, you know, really like putting your energy towards that, they really do make the colors pop. Like I mentioned here, there was a scene for me that stood out with Elsa entering the frozen island. There was like these blues and whites that really popped out. I think she was she was singing at that point as well, but it was like incredible.
Yeah,
because like, it was so simple, but it was so well done. And like she really stood out. And that horse as well, like that water horse or whatever it was, like incredibly like how they go about it. I still think Toy Story 4 in terms of like realism. Like,
oh, that's ridiculous how well created Toy Story 4 is. Like the lighting of this movie as well, I think is fantastic.
Mm. And in terms of some, I guess, fun facts, so at the end of the first film, Elsa gives Olaf a small magical snow cloud, which hovers over his head to keep him from melting. So this cloud is visible throughout the short Frozen Fever, but not in the featurette Olaf's Frozen Adventure. So there was also originally a song in this film, sung by Olaf, called Unmeltable Me, which explains how Elsa's magic has gotten more powerful, enabling her to make him unmeltable with the cloud.
Well, they did sort of describe it in one sentence in Frozen 2 by saying he's got permafrost.
Yeah. Yeah, they, which I'll buy. In the finished film, however, they only hint that we get like Anna's line, enjoying the new permafrost.
Yeah.
In a flashback scene, Prince Agnar says he's reading a book by some new Danish author. This is...
that was very strange.
Yeah. I know. I'm like...
I was like, wait, it's set on Earth? this has just been happening this whole time.
So this is apparently or probably an allusion to Hans Christian Andersen, whose fairy tale The Snow Queen inspired the plot of the original film. So there you go, some fun trivia in there. Young Elsa is also voiced by Mattia Conforti, who portrayed young Anna in the Broadway adaptation of Frozen. Also worth noting, the Walt Disney's Animation Studio, this is their 61st film and their last film of the 2010s. Do you think it's a good signing off?
It only makes sense for it to end the decade, really, because Frozen was just a huge bolt from the blue for Walt Disney Animation Studios. It really set it on straight and narrow. It had it up there with Pixar. I think some people were even suggesting that it overtaken Pixar once again, because there was a period where it looked like Pixar would become the dominant force in animation. So, yeah, it only makes sense for them to end with a sequel to what is quite possibly their most important film in years.
But yeah, probably of the last decade in terms of the animations. It's also the first theatrical sequel to a Disney animated princess movie. Interesting there as well. And the official teaser trailer was released on February 13th of this year. It proceeded to become the most viewed animated movie trailer of all time, with 116 million and a half views in the first 24 hours. So yeah, huge film. It's on another scale. It's a brand in and of itself. It carries a life, I think, beyond the screen. So I think that's what Disney's all about. You know, how we can make these films manifest into something more beyond the simple viewing experience. And just finally, the critical scores. It's received 7.3 on IMDb, 76% on Rotten Tomatoes, and 65% on Metacritic. So yeah, doing in the plus. I think that's the main takeaway from that.
Pretty much, yeah.
I think in terms of, like, animated sequels, there are so many bad ones that, like, I think the bar was pretty low for this one, kind of.
Yeah. Well, mind you, we've had the Toy Stories. They've all been pretty good.
Yeah. And they've always been the exception.
Incredibles 2.
Incredibles 2.
Oh, I love that.
So a bit of a lesser...
How to Train Your Dragon.
Bit of a lesser example here. The Wreck-It Ralph sequel. It was really different.
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I just want to put that out there. You know.
You're listening to the Film 101 podcast on Sin. We're going to go into our final segment of the day, looking at the week that was in cinema, or just a bit of news from what's happened in cinema in the last week. I don't think there's any. I always confuse myself here, Tom. You always put it straight. It's just the week that was.
The week that was in cinema.
That's all we're looking at.
It's self-explanatory.
So basically, starting off, and I think we're almost an extension of the final segment, but Frozen 2 has taken Disney Studios to beyond $3.2 billion in domestic ticket sales for all of their films in the US, setting a new record after eclipsing its 2018 record of $3.09 billion. Warner Brothers finished in second at $1.5 billion. Universal was third at $1.4 billion. Sony finished fourth at $1 billion, though Jumanji 2 is yet to be released, I've put here. But the production company for that is Columbia Pictures, though they are owned by Sony, so I think revenues will be counted under Sony.
Yeah, I think Sony is definitely going to jump up that list, because the first Jumanji was huge, and the initial...
It was like $1 billion, or close to.
Close to $1 billion. And this was despite the fact it was released, or perhaps in spite of the fact it was released alongside The Last Jedi, was it?
The first
Jumanji, or rather the second Jumanji, was only 2 years ago, which is extraordinary.
But the same thing's going to happen this year, so it's going to be that and Rise of Skywalker dominating.
Yeah, it's got like a week to figure it out.
It's kind of like what Smokey and the Bandit did with the Star Wars movies, releasing it at exactly the same time and taking advantage of,
you know. Programming is an actual thing, so... Yeah. Yeah. Kind of hopeful. I find it interesting that Disney's doing this well besides how poor all of their Fox products have been doing.
Have they released numbers for how much the Fox ones have made? I don't know.
I think they've all been under. Terminator one was definitely, like, deeply under.
It was. And I was looking at the figures for Ford v Ferrari, which is a film we all love here on Film 101.
Yeah, it was a good film.
And, it had a budget of $90 million, and it's only made back $120 million at the worldwide box office. So
it's still going, though.
So it's broke even in terms of its budget, but I don't think it's going to turn a profit for Disney.
I mean, what was Little Women? Is that Sony? Are they doing it? Yeah.
Little Women,
I think so.
Pretty sure Sony's doing that as well, okay, so I don't know how much that's going to make. Probably not a lot more.
I hope it does.
Oh, no, I hope for its sake that it does, because it's got an elite cast in there, and we'll be discussing it in, I think, a couple of weeks on the show. Frozen 2 has made Thanksgiving history in North America as well, after making approximately $123.7 million and beating former record holder The Hunger Games Catching Fire, which had $109.9 million. So, yeah, Frozen 2 is really... dominating right now. I don't know why I sound surprised. Like, the hype's obviously carried through for 6 years.
I was expecting it to do well, but I don't think, like you, I was expecting it to do as well as it did. It's extraordinary that even after 6 years, the franchise still has this much resonance with audiences.
Yeah, I figured it wasn't going to hold up in that same sense, like financially, but obviously kids have pulled their parents to the cinema.
It's the other way around. Parents are taking their kids. Yeah.
Well, I saw people at my screening. There was kids wearing like Elsa dresses and that. It was cool to see. But
I think it's like global audiences as well. Like, I think Japan. Japan for the first Frozen was like their highest grossing animated film, which is ridiculous from Japan.
And it came out like 2 or 3 months after. Yeah, the initial American release. Whereas with Frozen 2, I believe they've tried as hard as they can to do a global release. The first one, we got that on Boxing Day. Like, it's traditional for Thanksgiving releases to wait a month or so before they're released in Australia. But on this occasion, we only got it like 1 or 2 weeks after Frozen 2 was released in the US.
Well, yeah, then again, Star Wars wasn't being released at the end of the year. They had more of a chance to go into their summer,
which is their own like competition as well.
Well, oddly enough, Disney's films in 2019 have made a global sum of close to $10 billion, with The Rise of Skywalker yet to be released. So that film should, by the end of the year, take it over $10 billion. Quite ridiculous.
And this is the same year that they're releasing Disney Plus. Pretty big year for the old company.
Ridiculous.
For the old mouse house. Walt.
They acquired Fox this year, right? Earlier this year.
Officially signed July of this year.
So a lot has happened in the last year for Disney. It's still going. According to The Hollywood Reporter, for the first time... this is the first time that any box office analyst can remember, the top four holiday films after Walt Disney's Frozen 2 were adults skewing titles that weren't sequels or based on known IP. Those films are Knives Out, Ford v Ferrari, A Beautiful Day and A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, and Queen and Slim. Queen and Slim, which I don't think we've gotten yet here.
Or, no. And A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood is officially getting a release here the 23rd of January.
That's 2020. Upsetting, but we're still getting it. Like, from all accounts, four of these movies are really good.
And we get A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, it's worth noting, before we do The Lighthouse.
Yeah, well,
but let's say that.
Yeah. Last year we had that. I don't know why A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood is coming out when we had, what was the other one that came out last year?
Won't You Be My Neighbor.
So, Won't You Be My Neighbor, which was the documentary, and that only had a very limited release in Australia. Yeah. I think there were only one or two theatres in Melbourne that were showing it. So,
but here you've got Tom Hanks, so it's got to be a new
version. Yeah, so it will definitely make money if Tom Hanks is attached.
What does this mean, though, for original titles? Because there's been a fair few original titles this year that have done well, and then you look at past IP, sequels that have just bombed completely.
Well, it's saying to studios, especially, that audiences are eating up this sort of thing. They will go and see original movies, provided they're good quality and you market them right.
But we've seen, say last year, there was original films that didn't do as well commercially. I feel like this year has been a real sort of stepping stone in terms of that. Is it due to these kind of big star names as well?
I think that the sheep have finally woken up, Arnie. That's all I can say.
People are finally realizing we're getting a lot of
We're getting a lot of sequels. We're seeing the same old thing, and they want something new.
And I think the size of the 2019 blockbusters are bigger than they've ever been, with Endgame, with the end of Star Wars. Frozen 2 is going to make $2 billion. There's just so much space for smaller movies, I think, to operate.
I remember Ridley Scott bemoaning the fact in a roundtable with, I think it was The Hollywood Reporter, actually, that middle-class films were disappearing. And it was either being skewed towards blockbusters or those art house indie releases. But we're seeing studios especially try to bring that kind of movie back, that middle ground that's not quite a blockbuster, but not quite, one of those art house releases.
Yeah, and that's why rom-coms have basically been saved by streaming services. And that's why it's amazing as well, how well Hustlers has been doing.
Yeah.
This year.
Well, mind you, the regular, audience goer or film goer will see maybe 2, 3, 4 films at max, I think, a year.
Yeah.
So
that's
you've got to, and they probably save their money for number one, Avengers Endgame, number two, the
Star Wars.
Yeah, Star Wars. They're the two big films. So you've got to, those other two films that you're going to kind of hook them on. They've got to have, I think, some sort of new flair to them because, a lot of people have already set their minds on what they're going to see. Whether or not they're going to see anything else is highly relevant.
Yeah, I think that's why next year is going to be really interesting when there isn't really that many planned blockbuster kind of movies that we know about. So there's so much room for smaller movies or mid-budget movies to do well.
Well, we are getting Wonder Woman. I think the Thor sequels are coming out next year or the year after.
I think
Marvel
is taking
movies
a full year off.
Are they?
Pretty much.
Really?
I think so.
Oh.
I know Bad Boys is coming out next year. I think the new Shrek is coming out next year. There's a couple.
There's another Shrek?
Yes.
I really need to keep up with what's happening.
Nothing has been heard about it. I've just seen the 2020 with the Shrek, ears on the two. It's really gone under the radar. I know there was a countdown on Facebook to days till Shrek comes out. I don't know where that countdown's gone.
How have I not heard about this?
Yeah, dude, it's been going everywhere. I don't know. I think I'm hoping Eddie Murphy's going to be back as well, and Mike Myers and the sorts.
I'm sure.
Cameron Diaz, I'm not sure though whether she'll come back. Also, according to the Hollywood Reporter, quote unquote, an NGO based in Seoul has alleged that the film, being Frozen 2, occupied 88% of local screens on its opening day, violating Korea's anti-monopoly laws. The inquiry into the Disney release is expected to further inflame the debate over major studio dominance on the country's film market.
This isn't the first time this has happened. I mean, not in Korea, but when the seventh film came out, The Force Awakens, Quentin Tarantino was complaining because he'd released The Hateful Eight at the same time, and he wasn't able to find any multiplexes or blockbuster cinemas that would screen it because they'd all been taken up by Star Wars screenings.
I think he wasn't able to get the film's premiere in a specific venue,
which was what it was.
And then they went to I think it was on the Howard Stern show. Howard Stern called out Bob Iger and them to give the man his theater. He wants to show it on this projection.
This is basically what Marty Scorsese was saying with against Marvel movies. This is his whole argument that they're taking over smaller cinemas because they have to keep playing them. I will say though that this 88% number that they throughout. It's based on a metric, which is basically if it shows once in that cinema on that whole day, that counts for it. Mm. So the 88% doesn't mean 88% of like the total time that like any cinema is playing. It's 88% of like all screens.
Mm. Yeah.
For a day, yeah.
But mind you as well, you know, America's got a form of, less, probably more so now than before, but they've got a form of soft power on the likes of, you know, South Korea.
Mm.
And obviously they've probably got more influence as well in terms of an ability to showcase certain films. I don't know what the agreement is between certain studios and theatres in Seoul. Obviously, based on this, there is some sort of breach, but yeah.
I think 50% is their kind of, their limit.
Hey, so what would it be with China then? If I know they only have like a select few films that they bring in every year. I think that's been more lenient.
But it's also worth remembering that South Korea has a democratically elected government, whereas China's, I mean, they claim to have democracy, but it's really a one-party state, and they heavily control everything that comes into their country.
Mm. The Russo brothers also have said that Robert Downey Jr. deserves an Oscar nomination for Avengers Endgame. Is he going to get one? Are we pushing for that?
He's not. I mean, Robert Downey Jr., he's a great guy, wonderful actor. He's done really well in the role of Tony Stark. But to consider it like an Oscar-caliber performance is just laughable, really.
And this is a pretty loaded year for actors. It's not going to happen.
Disney were apparently, there was a list of like 13 actors they were campaigning for. Supporting. Because everyone's a supporting, pretty much a supporting cast.
Got on the For Your Consideration, you know, campaigns out at the moment, and specific websites for these campaigns, and you can actually search it up on whatever search engine you use and just say Disney For Your Consideration, and the first thing it'll bring up is the very website where they've got a list of all the possible nominations for all their films that they want to present to people.
There you go. Mm. If you want to go and, I guess, contact Disney, you've got your way.
Yeah.
In terms of the Gotham Independent Film Awards, the results were released about an hour and a half, 2 hours ago. So they basically recognise, again, independent cinema. So the winners for their Best Actor category were... there was Adam Driver for Marriage Story, Aldous Hodge for Clemency, Adam Sandler for Uncut Gems, Willem Dafoe for The Lighthouse, and Andre Holland for High Flying Bird. The winner was Adam Driver for Marriage Story.
Deserved.
Easy win.
As our listeners and as you two know, I'm not really fond of Marriage Story, but I'm not going to deny that Adam Driver was fantastic in that.
He's brilliant in whatever he's in, though.
Mm. He is essentially the actor of the decade as well. I think it's kind of a good way for
him
to wrap up.
And his best is still to come as well. We're going to see more of him.
He's 36. Mm. Yeah, so the guy's going to be casting crazy.
He just got a Lifetime Achievement Award essentially for Martin Scorsese at the New York Film Festival.
What?
It wasn't called that, but it was essentially that.
For Best Actress, Florence Pugh was nominated for Midsommar, Awkwafina for The Farewell, Mary Kay Place for Diane, Alfre Woodward for Clemency, and Elizabeth Moss for Her Smell. The winner was Awkwafina.
Yes.
I think before the show we were saying, and I know Tom, you mentioned that, you know, Scarlett Johansson's not in here.
Yeah, that was weird. Mm. Yeah.
No, that was very strange indeed, because, you know, it's one of those quite, I'm going to say it, Oscar-baity performances that she gives. So I thought,
I think
it
you
was...
mean it was really good and should win an Oscar.
sorry, yes, I'll rephrase that. But no, yeah, there were certain moments watching Marriage Story when you think to yourself, oh, yeah, this is going to be the clip they play during awards season. And, she hasn't popped up at all.
Big surprise there. Yeah.
Which is interesting as well, because I think the Gotham Awards, it kind of has a like pretty strong New York-based lenient kind of thing.
Right.
So I think Uncut Gems and Marriage Story were always going to be the big ones. So it's even more strange that ScarJo didn't get nominated.
Mm. Mm. And in terms of the audience award, Marriage Story won that one.
Yeah, see?
Yep, so there you go. People loved it.
Mm.
I say people, I don't say Tom.
Am I not a person? Is that what you're saying?
For Best Screenplay, Lulu Wang's The Farewell was in there. Terrell Alvin McCraney's High Flying Bird. Jimmy Fails' Joe Talbo and Robert Richards' The Last Black Man in San Francisco. Noah Baumbach's Marriage Story and Ari Aster for Midsommar. The winner was... Noah Baumbach for Marriage Story for Best Screenplay.
I can see where this is heading.
The nominees are interesting, though. I feel like that could be a pretty good precursor for, maybe not the Oscars, but maybe the Independent Spirit Awards.
I have actually heard that people are strongly pushing for Lulu Wang to get a nomination in the screenplay category for The Farewell.
Yeah. Mm.
And lastly, for best feature, there was The Farewell, Uncut Gems, Waves, Marriage Story, and Hustlers.
Let me guess,
they won the most awards that night. I think it was four or five awards. Four proper ones, and then the audience.
What would you rather have won out of that list?
Oh, sorry, they won four.
Okay, so, well, Hustlers, probably. But or The Farewell, actually. Or Uncut Gems. I think you see where this is
they're
going.
They're all the most New York movies.
Yeah, I think... Yeah, I'm actually quite surprised that The Lighthouse wasn't nominated, given like all the hype it's been receiving from the public in the US and from critics. So,
and the fact that Willem was probably... That was, he was
yeah, he was nominated in the actor
and
category
not even
as well.
Pattinson.
And I think that does it for us today for the show. Thank you for tuning in. We looked at Klaus, Frozen 2, and The Week That Was in Cinema. Next week, we'll return again with a couple of different sort of films. I think we can give a little sneak peek. The Addams Family, the animated version this time, is out. So we'll be discussing that one, and there'll be another film in there as well. Mm-hmm. Tom, where can you find us?
Well, you can find us, Arnie, on Facebook by visiting facebook.com/film101. SYN. We're also on Twitter at film101SYN. And you can send us an email, film101SYN@gmail.com. And of course, there's our podcast on Omni and all of your favorite streaming services.
Indeed. And until next week.
Bye bye.
Yeah.